Osho Talk. Zen, The Path of Paradox, Volume 1, Number 3.
A certain Zen master remarked laconically to a student who had been talking at some length about Zen theory, "You have too much Zen." "But is it not natural for a student of Zen to talk about Zen?" inquired the puzzled pupil. "Why do you hate talking about Zen?" "Because," replied the master flatly, "it turns my stomach."
"Devise no world," says the founder of Zen, Bodhidharma, "because with the world starts the world." Exactly that is what the Bible says. In the beginning was the world. And in the end also is the world. The moment you enter into the world of words, you start falling away from that which is. The more you enter into language, the farther away you are from God. Language is a great falsification. It is not a bridge. It is not a communication. It is the barrier. Bodhidharma says, "Devise no world." If your mind creates no world, in that silence is God, our truth, our nirvana. The moment the world enters, you are no more in your own self. You have gone away. The world takes you on a journey away from yourself. In fact, you cannot go away from yourself, but you can dream about it. In fact, you are always there. You can only be there and nowhere else. But still, you can fall asleep. And you can dream 1001 dreams. Let me tell you again one of the most beautiful stories ever devised, the story of Adam's fall. It says, God forbids Adam not to eat from the tree of knowledge. Zen will agree perfectly. Because this is knowledge that is making you stupid. It is knowledge that is not allowing you to know. Adam was capable to know before he has eaten the fruit from the tree of knowledge. The moment he has eaten knowledge, the moment he becomes knowledgeable, he knows no more. That innocence is lost. He becomes cunning and clever. That intelligence is lost. Yes, he starts growing intellect. But intelligence is no more there. Intellect has nothing to do with intelligence. It is just the contrary, the opposite. More you are an intellectual, less intelligent you are bound to be. In fact, intellect is a substitute to hide your unintelligence. It is a counterfeit. You don't have intelligence, so you substitute by intellect. Intellect is, of course, cheap. You can purchase it anywhere. It is available. In fact, people are too willing to impart their knowledge to you. They are ready to throw all their rubbish in you. Adam became knowledgeable. Hence the fall. So knowledge is the fall. The story says he has eaten an apple, a fruit from the tree of knowledge. It can't be an apple. Apples don't grow on the tree of knowledge. Somewhere the story has got mixed. And the apples are so innocent. Just by eating an apple, you cannot be thrown out of heaven. You cannot be expelled. God cannot be so angry with you. No, it can't be apple. Apple is just metaphoric. It must be the word, language. On the tree of knowledge, fruits of words, concepts, philosophy, systems grow, not apples. Forget the apple, remember the word. And then, the serpent is the first teacher of humanity, the first education system, that serpent, that is the first demagogue, the first academician. He has taught the trick of knowledge. He persuaded Eve to eat. He could not persuade Adam directly. Why he could not persuade Adam directly? Why he had to persuade Eve first? Eve is more vulnerable. Women are always more vulnerable, more open, soft, can be taken anywhere by anybody. More suggestible, can be hypnotized more easily than men. The serpent persuaded the woman. He was not only the first academician, he was the first salesman too. And he did well. But he was not wrong. Whatsoever he was saying, he was right. He was saying, you will become knowledgeable. You will know what is what. Without eating this fruit, you will never know what is what. There is a kind of knowing which is totally different. You know and yet you cannot know what is what. It is a very diffused kind of knowing. It does not categorize. It does not divide. It is non-analytical. Adam must have lived in that non-analytical innocence. Science was not possible. Religion, there was, sovereign all over. Adam must have been a mystic before he ate from the tree of knowledge, as every child is a mystic. Every child is a born mystic. Then he drag him, then we drag him towards the school and the education and the serpent. The serpent is the civilization, the culture, the conditioning. And the serpent is such a cunning animal that the metaphor seems to be perfect. Such a crooked animal, such a slippery, just like logic. You can't decide where it is moving. And it moves without legs. It has no legs to move, but goes so fast. It is exactly like untruth. It has no legs. That's why the untruth has always to borrow legs from truth. That's why every untrue statement tries hard to prove that I am true. Those are the borrowed legs. The serpent, the first teacher, the first academician, convinced Eve, and naturally Eve could easily convince Adam. The woman has always been powerful over man. Whatsoever the man goes on thinking is irrelevant, notwithstanding what man pretends. Man goes on pretending that he is more powerful. That is simply nonsense. And the women allow the man to think about it. It is perfectly okay. Let him think. It does not change the situation. The woman has remained powerful. And there is a reason, because the feminine is more powerful than the masculine. The soft is more powerful than the hard. The water is more powerful than the rock. You can ask Lao Tzu, who is a man of knowing. He knows. He is not a man of knowledge, but he knows. And he says, if you want to become infinitely powerful, become feminine. Become passive. The passive is always more powerful, more pregnant than the active. That's why man does not become pregnant. He is desert-like. The woman has the capacity to become pregnant. She is potential. She carries life. She can contain life in her. Many lives she can contain in her. Adam falls into the trap, becomes interested, must have thought that if I become more knowledgeable, I will become more active. I will know more, must have become ambitious. And that's what the serpent has done. The serpent has said, if you eat, you will become like gods. So powerful like gods. And that's why God has prohibited not to eat. He is afraid. He is jealous. And each son thinks the same way, that the father is jealous of me. He is afraid of me, that he wants me never to become so powerful as he is powerful, so he always remains in control. This biblical parable is such a great parable. It has such great insight. But Adam was in a state of knowing, then he became knowledgeable. Religion disappeared, science was born. Science, the word science exactly means knowledge. Those fruits were the fruits of science. He lost his innocence and became cunning. And this happens every time a child is born into the world. Each child is born into God's garden, the Garden of Eden. And each child is persuaded by the serpent of civilization, culture, education, is conditioned, is pulled, manipulated towards ambition, towards ego goals, become like gods. That's the whole idea behind science. Science thinks that one day or other it will be able to know all the mysteries, and then man will be a god, infinitely powerful. It is an ambition, an ego trip. We drag each child towards the ego. And ego lives on language. So the more articulate the child is, the more egoistic he becomes. The better he can express and communicate through language, the more famous he becomes. He will become a leader of men, or he may become a great author, a writer, a poet, and this and that. These are the people who are the most famous people in the world. He will become a thinker, or a professor, or a philosopher, and these are the people who dominate. Why they dominate? In this world, the man who is articulate with language is the dominant man. You cannot think of a dumb leader. And you cannot think a man who cannot speak and is not expressive of what he thinks becoming famous. Impossible. All fame comes to language. So the child starts becoming more and more entangled with language, with the word, and says Bodhidharma devise no words. I have called the serpent the first teacher. Then the whole work of the religious master is nothing but how to undo the serpent. How to undo that which has been taught to you. How to undo the whole educational system. How to make you free of your conditionings. How to help you to drop the word. The moment you drop the word, you are again innocent. That's what saintlyhoodness is. Innocence. Primal innocence. The moment language disappears from your mind and you are no more spinning into words, a great silence arises. A silence that you have almost forgotten. You are not at all alert that you had it one day. It was there permitting you when you were in the womb of your mother. When you were born and you had opened your eyes for the first time, it was there permitting the whole existence. It was there very, very alive. You have lived in it for few days, few months, few years. Slowly, slowly it disappears. The dust gathers and the mirror reflects no more. When people start saying that now you are a grown-up, they are simply saying you have lost your innocence. They have corrupted you. They have hypnotized you into language. Now you don't see, you think. Now you don't know, you think. Now you go about and about and about, and you never hit the target itself. Round and round you go. You will talk about God. You will talk about love. And you will talk about this and that. And you will never know anything. Because to know love, one has to be loving. It does not help to think about it, to read about it. You can become one of the greatest experts about love, and you will not know an iota of it. It is an experience. The language is very tricky. It substitutes the real with the about. One day a man came to me and he says, I have come to know about God. I said, why about? Why not God Himself? Why about? And how it is going to help if you know about God? Yes, you will accumulate a little information. You will become more knowledgeable. But that is not going to help. That is not going to transform you. That is not going to become your inner luminousness. You will remain as dark as before. The whole effort of a Jesus or a Buddha or a Bodhidharma is nothing but how to undo that which the society has done to you. These are the most antisocial people in the world. They destroy whatsoever the society has created around you. All the fences around you. All the defenses around you. All the walls around you. They destroy. They go on destroying. They are great nihilists. They simply destroy. Because that which is need not be created. It is already there. It has not to be invented. It has only to be discovered. Or will be better to say rediscovered. You had known it. That's why we have a very, very dim, dark feeling for bliss. Somehow we know what it is. Although we cannot put it exactly in words what it is. We are seeking for it. We are groping in the dark and moving towards something called bliss. How? If you had not known it before, how you can go on groping for it? You must have known it sometime. You may have forgotten, true. But you must have known. And somewhere deep in your unconscious, in the recesses of your being, you must be carrying a nostalgia, a dream. That is exactly the case. You have known God. You have lived as a God. When you was a child, you have lived without ego. Before you came in the contact with the serpent. You had known. Your eyes were clear. You had a transparent clarity. You were able to see through and through. You had lived like a god. And you had known what bliss is. But now it is forgotten. But still it goes on knocking somewhere deep down from your unconscious. Seek it. Seek it again. Hence you seek God. Hence you seek meditation. Hence you seek love. Hence you seek all that you seek. Sometimes in the right direction. Sometimes in the wrong direction. But you are continuously seeking one thing that you know was there. And that you know is no more there. The day you will know what God is, the day you will meet that experience, you will laugh. You will say, so this is God, but I had known it before. I can recognize it. That's how people recognize, otherwise how they will recognize? If suddenly one day you come across me and you have not known me, how you will recognize? People have recognized. When Buddha came to that moment, he could recognize immediately, yes, this is it. When Bodhidharma came to that moment, he started laughing. He said, so this is it. This has been there in my childhood. Was destroyed. Was contaminated. Dust was thrown in my eyes and my clarity was lost. Now the eyes are again functioning well and I can see it. God is that which is. You are gods, unawares, fallen asleep. One thing more about the biblical story. It says God expelled Adam. That's not right. God cannot expel. That way, God is powerless. Where he will expel, tell me. Where? It is all his garden. Wherever you are in the garden. From one end to another end, it is the Garden of Eden. There is no way to expel. God's kingdom is infinite. How can he expel you? Where he will expel? There is no other place. His is the only world. There is no other world. Adam is not expelled. God cannot expel because there is no place to expel. Secondly, God cannot expel because Adam is God. Adam is part of God. How can you expel your own part? I cannot expel my hands and I cannot expel my leg. It is not possible. Adam's expulsion will be a mutilation of God himself. No, he cannot do that. He is not a masochist. He cannot cut himself into parts. God is compassion. Adam is not expelled, then what has happened? Adam has fallen asleep, eating the fruit from the tree of knowledge. He has fallen asleep. Now, he no more looks at reality, he dreams about it. Now he has his own ideas. He has his own concepts. He has his own visions. Now he has become a fabricator. Now he goes on inventing. Rather than seeing that which is, he goes on inventing. He is using that which is only as a screen to project his language world. That's why Bodhidharma says, devise no world. And if you have already devised, undevise them. Drop them. This is one of the most fundamental messages of Zen. They call this state in China Mo Chao, when you are not devising any world. Mo means serene or silent, and Chao means reflection or awareness. Reflection does not mean, as it usually means in English, it does not mean contemplation. It means a mirror-like quality. It exactly, literally means reflection. Mo Chao means serene reflection. The lake is silent. No ripples. It reflects perfectly. It is a full moon night and the full moon is reflected in the lake. And have you seen it? The moon in the reflection is far more beautiful than the moon in the sky. Something is added unto it. The serenity of the lake, the silence of the lake, the coolness of the lake, the mirror-like beauty of the lake is added into it. It is something more. When God reflects in you, in your Mo Chao, God becomes even more beautiful. Something is added. But if you think, then there are ripples. Then the lake is in turmoil. Then you are not in a state to reflect. Then you are very, very destructive to the reality. Then, the moon is not reflected as it is. It is disturbed by our ripples. And if there are great waves, of course, the destruction is even more. Then you don't add anything to the beauty of moon. You take all beauty away. And it is a perversion. It is not exactly as the moon is. It is something else. It is not true. It is untrue. This mochao, serene reflection, is expressed in a famous poem by Zen master Hung Chi. Silently and serenely, one forgets all words. Clearly and vividly, that appears before him. When one realizes it, it is vast and without edges. In its essence, one is clearly aware. Singularly reflecting in this bright awareness, full of wonders, is this pure reflection. Dew and the moon, stars and streams, snow on pine trees, and clouds hovering on the mountain peaks. From darkness they all become glowingly bright. From obscurity they all turn to resplendent light. Infinite wonder permeates this serenity. In this reflection, all intentional efforts vanish. Serenity is the final word of all teachings. The truth of serene reflection is perfect and complete. Ah, look, the 100 rivers flow in tumbling torrents in the great ocean. The Zen is based on mochao, a serene reflection. This has to be understood. By serenity is not meant a forced stillness. You can force your mind to be still. That won't help much. That's what so many people who think they are meditators are doing in the world. They force the mind violently. They are very aggressive upon their minds. If you go on being aggressive, you will come to a point where the mind, out of sheer tiredness, yields. But this will be only on the surface. Deep in the recesses of your unconscious, the turmoil will continue. It will be a false serenity. A false serenity is a false serenity. It is not real. No, will cannot bring it. By effort it cannot be brought. It comes only through understanding, not by will. So never try to replace understanding by will. Although the temptation is great, always the temptation is there. Because to do something through will looks easier. To do something through violence looks easier. To do the same thing through love and understanding looks very, very difficult. And it seems it will take millennia to arrive. So we always try to find a shortcut. And there are no shortcuts in spiritual growth. There have never been and there will never be. So don't fall a victim of a shortcut. The serenity has to grow, not forced. It has to come from your innermost core, through understanding. That's why Try to understand what language has done to you. Try to understand what language is already destroyed in you. Try to understand your knowledgeability is not your knowing. Look into it. Watch it. In different situations, be aware of it, how it distracts you from reality. You come across a rose flower, and the moment you see it, immediately jumps language in, and something inside your mind says, a beautiful rose flower, and you have desired something. Now it is neither beautiful nor a rose. A word is there. Don't allow the word to interfere each and every of your experience. Sometimes, just be there with the rose and don't say a rose. There is no need. The rose has no name. The names are given by us. And the name is not the real thing. So if you keep too much attached with the name, you will miss the real. The name will come in your eyes and it will project something. All the past roses. When you say it is a rose, you are classifying it. And no rose can be classified because all roses are so unique and so individual. Classification is just not possible. Don't give it a class. Don't pigeonhole it. Don't put it in a box. Enjoy its beauty. Enjoy its color. Enjoy its dance. Just be there. Don't say anything. Watch. Be in mo chao. A silent, serene reflection. Just reflect. Let the rose flower reflect in you. You be a mirror. If you can become a mirror, you have become a meditator. Meditation is nothing but a skill in mirroring. And now no word moves inside you. So no distraction. Words are associated with each other and linked with each other. One word leads to another and that leads to another and you have gone far away. The moment said this is a beautiful rose, immediately you remember the girlfriend who used to like beautiful roses. And then you remember all that happened with the girlfriend, the fantastic love affair, the honeymoon. And then the misery that naturally follows. And the divorce. And all that. And this flower, you have forgotten all about it. This rose flower is no more there. The language, the word distracted you and you went into a journey. One word leads to another. There is a continuous linkage. All words are linked, interlinked. Great association. You just use one word and just wait and see how it starts spinning things. You say dog, just an ordinary word, and just wait for a second and immediately you start moving with that word. You remember one dog in your childhood used to horrify you, just the neighbor's dog. And you were so much afraid when you used to come from your school. And your heart starts beating again. And you start feeling a little fear arising. That dog is still too much. And then you remember the neighbor and so on and so forth. One thing leads to 1001 things. And there is no end to it. Yes, the word is in the beginning. The biblical statement is perfectly true. Everything starts with the word. The world starts with the world. When you drop the world disappears. Then you are in God. Again, the expelled sun is back. He has awakened. So don't force silence upon yourself. That's why my insistence here is not to force, rather dance, sing. Let your activity be satisfied. Let your mind run hither and thither. Let it get tired on its own accord. Jump and breathe and dance and jog and swim. And when you feel now your body and mind are tired, then sit silently and watch. By and by, small moments of serenity will start entering you. They come in drops. There is a particular word for it. Buddhists have called it chitta chana, a moment of consciousness. These chitta chanas, these atomic moments of consciousness, start floating in you. They come like intervals. One word has left, another has not arisen. Just in between the two, suddenly a window opens, an interval, a gap, and you can see reality very clearly, very luminous. You can see again with those eyes of childhood that you have forgotten completely. The world is again psychedelic, very colorful, very alive, full of wonders. That's what this Hungachi says. Full of wonder is this pure reflection. Infinite wonder permeates this serenity. Wonder is the taste of that serenity. The modern mind has lost all capacity to wonder. It has lost all capacity to look into the mysterious, into the miraculous. Because of the knowledge, because it thinks it knows, the moment you think you know, wonder stops arising. The moment you start again becoming less knowledgeable, wonder enters back. It starts penetrating you. Watch it. If you think you know this tree, then you are no more in any wonder about it. That's why your own wife and her beauty does not fill your eyes with wonder. You think you know her. Had she been somebody else's wife, you would have been certainly attracted. But now you think you know her. Now you think you are acquainted with her. And you are not. Because each person is such a unique mystery, there is no way to know. You cannot know a woman by becoming a husband. And you cannot know a man by becoming a wife. You may have lived for 30 years together, but you don't know. You remain strangers. Because we are all mysteries, there is no way to get acquainted. And each moment, the unpredictable is possible. And sometimes you come across it. You have lived for 10 years with a woman, and suddenly one day she is angry, and you had never thought that she will be so angry. 10 years, you have watched her, and she has been always so tender, so loving, so compassionate, and suddenly one day she is so angry that she would like to kill you. Unpredictable. And you were getting settled. And you had started taking her for granted. And you were thinking that you know her. Nobody knows anybody. Neither she knows you nor you know her. Yes, you may have given birth to a child. The child has remained 9 months in your womb. But you don't know. When the child comes, he is as unpredictable as anybody else's child. And don't for a single moment think that you know anybody. We are strangers. And so is this whole existence. These trees that surround you here, you see them every day. And by, you have stopped seeing them because you think now you know. What is the point? Please, listen to me. Have a look again. And you will be surprised. Nothing is ever known. Knowledge happens not. Knowledge is just sheer ignorance. Life remains mysterious. Yes, we can enjoy it. We can dance with it. We can sing with it. We can celebrate. That's possible, but we cannot know it. All the great masters of the world have said knowledge is not possible. It is not in the nature of things. And whatsoever you think you know is just so-so, your make-believe. And because of that make-believe, you become so burdened that you stop wondering. A child wonders because he does not know. Once he starts getting acquainted, he reads geography and history and all kinds of nonsense, and then he thinks he knows. Then the flower does not smell anymore the way it used to. Then the butterfly does not attract anymore as it used to. Then he will not collect seashells on the seashore. He has become a grown-up. In fact, he has stopped growing. In fact, he has died. The day you think you know, your death has happened. Because now there will be no wonder and no joy and no surprise. Now you will live a death life. You can enter into your grave. You will not be losing anything. Because you are not going to be surprised by anything. So what is the point of going on living? Commit suicide. In fact, that's what actually we are doing. We commit suicide. The day you think you know, you have committed suicide. With this mochao, with this serene reflection, again you will become a child. Again you will attain to those beautiful eyes of childhood, innocent, unknowing, yet penetrating. So remember, sereneness or silence is not calmness, it is not quietude. It implies transcendency over all words and thoughts, denoting a state of beyond, of pervasive peace. It is not a still mind. It is stillness itself. It is not a disciplined thing out of your effort. It is nothing to be practiced. It is something to be understood, to be loved. You have to play with it rather than work it out. It is absence of mentation. Yes, that's what meditation is all about. Absence of mentation. The mind is no more thinking. The mind is silent. It has no savor of mental activity. It is clear awareness in the tranquility of nothingness. The Japanese have a beautiful word for it. They call it kokoro. Kokoro means absolute nothingness. Kokoro means a tremendous absence. Kokoro means blankness, but not negative. Nothingness gives the sense of something being negated. No. All that is rubbish is negated, certainly, obviously. But once you negate all that is rubbish, your own innermost nature asserts. It is very positive. When the ripples have disappeared from the lake, you can say, now there exists nothing on the surface of the lake. Absolute nothingness resides, floats. But this is not a negative state. In fact, now the lake asserts itself into its total silence. Its nature is visible on the surface. Those waves and ripples were hiding it. Now it is there, just present. Not noisy, very silent. Not declaring that I am here. There is no I anymore. I is nothing but all your noise together, put together. When noise disappears, when the mind is no more, meditation is no more there, suddenly you are for the first time, and yet you are not. You are not in the old way. You have died and you are reborn. This is the second childhood. Master Suigan, at the end of the summer session, made this declaration. I have been talking east and west all this summer for my brotherhood. See if my eyebrows are still growing. One of his disciples said, how finely they are growing, sir. Another said, one who commits a theft feels uneasy in his heart. And a third one, without saying anything, simply uttered, Kwan. Kwan is just an ejaculation with no sense attached to it. Nor is it a symbol. It is the thing itself. The master has been talking. Now this is the irony, the paradox. Even a Zen master has to talk. He talks against talking. But still he has to talk. It's almost like you have a disease and the disease is poisoning you, and we prepare a medicine from another poison to destroy the disease. Almost all medicines are prepared out of poison. To kill poison, you have to use poison. There is a thorn in your feet. We search for another thorn to take that thorn out of the feet. A thorn has to be pulled by another thorn. Yes, it is ironical. But even a Zen master has to talk continuously. Buddha talked for 42 years continuously, morning, afternoon, evening, and in between. And talked only one thing, that is, stop talking, that be silent, that device no words. Now this master has talked, this Suigan has talked for many months, and then at the conclusion of the session, he says, I have been talking east and west all this summer for my brotherhood. See if my eyebrows are still growing. He is saying, look, am I still alive or dead? So much talk, I may have fallen dead. I may have stopped growing. The first disciple said, how finely they are growing. He is true. 100% true. He can see in the Master. Those words have not disturbed the silence of the Master. They have not become his death. His life is flowing as ever. They have not become any obstruction. You are allowed to talk only when your words don't destroy your silence. When your silence remains untouched by your words, then you can talk. Then your words will be a blessing to the world. Then you will help many people to come out of their words. Then your words will become a medicine. But if your word disturbs your silence, if while you are speaking, you lose contact with your innermost core of serenity, mochao, then it is futile. Then it is better to heal yourself first. Physician, heal thyself. Then don't start healing anybody. You will harm rather than healing anybody. The disciple says, "Yes, Master, how finely they are growing, I can see. Your silence remains undisturbed." The second disciple says, "One who commits a theft feels uneasy in his heart, even better than the second." He says, "Master, although you are beyond theft, but still, even if you commit theft, you will feel guilty." We know that words don't disturb you, but still, words are such nuisance that you are feeling a little bit guilty. I can see it. And I can understand the second disciple's idea. Yes, speaking to you, I also feel guilty. Because there is every danger. You may not listen what I am saying. You may not listen what I mean to say. And you may start talking just like me. That danger is there. I am committing a crime. It has to be committed because there seems to be no other way to help you. That risk has to be taken. The second disciple reaches a little deeper. First was 100% correct. Remember, the second one is 200% correct. He says, "Master, one who commits a theft feels uneasy in his heart. I can see it." The third is 300% correct. And the third one, without saying anything, simply uttered, "Kwan." It is just like "who." Because to say anything is meaningless. He simply utters a sound. And he is saying, "Whatsoever you have been talking is just empty sound, sir. Don't be worried. Whatsoever you have been talking is just hot air, just like my koan." Yes, it is good sometimes to help a man wake up. But it doesn't mean anything. If somebody is fast asleep and you shout in his ear, "Kwan," he will open his eyes, that's all. The work is done. But the "Kwan" does not mean anything. That's exactly what all the utterances of all the masters are. A "Kwan." They don't mean anything. They don't carry any philosophy in them. They are just shouts to wake you up. The third has understood totally. He is exactly in the same space as the Master himself. This koan, from where it comes? It comes from kokoro, nothingness. And when you are in this nothingness, everything is possible. This nothingness is so potent. This nothingness is so positive. This nothingness is God. The Buddhists don't use the word God, because God seems to be confining. They use nothingness, kokoro, sunyata. In this nothingness you will see God is omnipresent. This nothingness is filling the whole existence. These are the words of John Donne. God is so omnipresent that God is an angel in an angel, and a stone in a stone, and a istra in a istra. In this nothingness, you would have penetrated into the very nature of things. This penetration into the nature of things is the goal. And that is possible only when you devise no word. Then things are. Listen to these words of Wordsworth. The cock is crowing, the stream is flowing, the small words twitter, the lake doth glitter, the green fields sleep in the sun. Then everything is as it is. The cock is crowing, and the green fields sleep in the sun. God is so omnipresent that God is an angel, and in a stone, and in a stra. Then God disappears. There is only godliness. Then there is no deity. There is only divineness. Pure, liquid divineness overfilling all the space. I was reading just the other night Leonardo da Vinci's diary. In his diary he writes one sentence that struck me. Among the great things which are to be found among us, the being of nothingness is the greatest. Kokoro. That being of nothingness comes through no word, no language, no concept, no mind, no mentation, mo chao. Now, this is a small parable. A certain Zen master remarked laconically to a student who had been talking at some length about Zen theory. Now, the first thing, Zen has no theory. It is a non-theoretical approach into reality. It has no doctrine and no dogma. Hence, it has no church, no priest, no pope. Zen is so earthly, down to earth. It does not deal in abstract concepts. That's a rare phenomenon that came out of two geniuses meeting, the Indian genius and the Chinese genius. The Indian genius is very abstract, even Buddha. He tries hard not to be abstract, but what can he do? An Indian is, after all, an Indian. The Indian genius is very abstract. It talks about great things, theories, spins, great ideas. It flies into the high sky. It never lands on the earth. The Indian genius has not known how to land back on the earth for centuries. It goes up and then it does not know how to come back. It has no roots. It has wings, but no roots. That is the misery. The Chinese genius is more earthbound, more practical, more pragmatic. They don't go into the sky too much. Even if they go a little, they always keep their feet on the earth, rooted in the earth. They don't fly like a bird. They go into the sky like a tree. They keep their roots in the earth. They always keep very deep proportion. Lao Tzu is very practical, so is Confucius. When Bodhidharma went to China with the great message of Zen, there happened a great meeting, a great synthesis between the Indian genius and the Chinese genius. Zen is neither Indian nor Chinese. It carries both, and yet it is beyond both. So if you ask an Indian Buddhist, there are very few. If you ask an Indian Buddhist, he will not take Zen seriously. He will say all nonsense. Wherever Indian Buddhism is still prevalent in Ceylon, in Burma, in Thailand, nobody talks about Zen. People laugh. They say it is like a joke. If you talk to Chinese Zen people and the Japanese Zen people about great Buddhist scriptures, they say burn them immediately. All abstract theories are nonsense. They take man astray from reality. To me, Zen is one of the greatest syntheses, a transcendental phenomenon. The first thing about it is existential, not theoretical. It does not say anything about truth. It gives you truth as it is. It simply wakes you up. It shocks you to wake up. It shouts you to wake up. But it does not give you theories. It does not give you doctrines. It does not give you scriptures. Zen is the only religion which is capable of burning scriptures. The only religion which is capable of destroying all idols and all ideals too. A certain Zen master remarked laconically to a student who had been talking at some length about Zen theory. Zen has no theory. That is unique about Zen. The moment you start talking about Zen theory, Zen is no more Zen. There is theory, but no more Zen. Zen and theory can't exist together. Theory is very limited. Zen is an unlimited experience. Zen is more like love. You cannot define it. Said the master, you have too much Zen. Such a beautiful statement. He says, you have too much Zen. He is saying you have nothing of Zen in you. That's how Zen masters talk. He wants to say you have nothing of Zen in you. But he says, on the contrary, you have too much Zen. How can you have too much Zen? Either you have it or you don't have it. This is a way of saying that you don't have any Zen in you. You have too much of Zen means you have too much of theories. You know too much about it. And you have not even had a single glimpse of it. But is it not natural for a student of Zen to talk about Zen? Inquired the puzzled pupil. The second thing. First, there is no theory in Zen. Second, there cannot be anybody called a student of Zen. It is not possible. A student looks for the theory. A student wants to become knowledgeable. A student goes to the serpent, not to the master. The student goes to the teacher. The student goes to a college, a university, an institution. Zen has no students. Zen has no theory, so it cannot have students, it cannot have professors. Yes, it has masters and it has disciples. A master is not a teacher, remember. The work of the master is exactly the opposite of the teacher. The teacher teaches you. The teacher makes you learn many things. The master helps you to unlearn. The master is the antidote of the teacher. In the dictionary, you will find they mean the same, but remember, at least in the world of Zen, they don't mean the same. I am a master, I am not a teacher. And those who are really here are not students, but disciples. What is the difference between a student and a disciple? The student wants to know more, grab more. The student wants to become a scholar. The student is hankering for the tree of knowledge. The student wants to eat as many apples as possible. The student is on an ego trip, curious, inquiring, but not ready to be transformed. The disciple is a different phenomenon. The disciple is not hankering for knowledge. He wants to see, not to know. He wants to be. He is no more interested in having more knowledge. He wants to have more being. His direction is totally different. If to have more being, he has to drop all his knowing, he is ready. He is ready to sacrifice everything. The disciple is not a holder. The student is a holder. And of course, when you hold in the memory. Memory goes on growing in the mind of a student, but not his consciousness. Inside a disciple, the memory by and by starts disappearing. He does not carry the burden of the past anymore. He knows only the very essentials. His knowledge is utilitarian, but his consciousness starts growing. His whole energy moves from memory to consciousness. There is a great difference between a student and a disciple. The student wants to know about. His whole effort is how to think better. The disciple wants to be. His whole effort is how to be. How to come back home. How to attain to those childhood eyes again. How to be reborn. That's what Jesus means when he says, unless you are born again. He was searching for disciples. And to the man, Nicodemus, whom he said this, unless you are born again, you will not understand me and you will not be able to enter my kingdom of God. You may not know that man Nicodemus was a professor. And he had come in search of knowledge. He was a famous rabbi. He was on the board of the great temple of Jerusalem. He had not come in the day because he was afraid people will laugh. Such a great scholar, a well-known professor all over the country, going to an ordinary man, a hippie-type man. Yes, Jesus was a hippie, moving with uneducated people, unsocial elements, befriending prostitutes, befriending all kinds of people, staying with people who were not respectable. And he was a young man. and looked crazy. He was. And he was talking such things only neurotics are. Buddhas can talk. And whenever there is a question to decide for you, whether he is a Buddha or a neurotic, you will decide he is a neurotic. Because to decide that he is a Buddha is against your ego. So people knew that he is a little neurotic, a little mad, eccentric, and he has gathered some dangerous people around him. Nicodemus could not go to him in the daylight, in the mid of the night. He went and he inquired. He inquired, what is this kingdom of God? What do you go on talking about? What is this? I want to know about it more. About it, mind you. And Jesus says, unless you are born again, you will not know what it is. Now this is too much for Nicodemus. Born again? That much price to die and to be born again? This seems too much. A student is ready to pay in small coins. A disciple is ready to pay with his life. A student has an inquiry. The disciple, it is not just an inquiry. In English, there is no right word for it. In Sanskrit, we have a word, mumuksha. For inquiry, we have another word, jigyasa. It means one wants to know more. Mumuksha means one wants to be more. One wants to be freed from all confinements. One wants no more to be contained in any kind of slavery. Of the tradition, of the scripture, of the society, of the state, one wants no more any kind of slavery. One wants to be free, utterly free. That rebellion, this urge to be totally free is mumuksha. In the English language, there is no word to translate it. We can call it the desire to become desireless. The desire to be so utterly free that not even this desire remains. Now, the student says, but is it not natural for a student of Zen to talk about Zen? He is a student. He is not a disciple. That's where things are messy. And he says, it is not natural, yes, it is natural for a student. What else the student can do? The student and the scholar and the professor, they deal in words. They devise words. They coin new words. They go on playing with words. Their whole business is of words. Empty, impotent words, but they go on playing with those words and creating new. Is it not natural, he says, for a student of Zen to talk about Zen? For the student, it of course looks very unnatural not to talk about Zen. Then what is the point of coming to a master? What is the point of coming to a Zen monastery? If one cannot talk, it is natural. It is not natural for a disciple. A disciple has come to become silent. A disciple knows to be silent is natural. Listen to the master in silence. In fact, don't listen too much to his words. Listen to his silence, which is always there behind the words. You start by listening his words, and then by and by you start listening to his silence. Slowly, slowly, you graduate from words to silence. Slowly, slowly, a shift happens. The gestalt changes. You are no more concerned what the master is saying. You become concerned what he is. For a disciple, that is natural. But for a student, of course, what else he can do? He can talk. inquired the puzzled disciple, is it not natural for a student of Zen to talk about Zen? Why do you hate talking about Zen, he says. The master does not hate. The master cannot hate. He simply sees the futility of it. Remember, love and hate both are relationships. The master is not related with the world at all. He is not in love with language and he does not hate. Because hate is again a relationship. You are not freed yet. You are still attached. In a reverse way. But you are still attached. You are still worried. You may be escaping from language, but you are still not free. And you are still concerned with language. And the language will go on haunting you. No, the master is not against it. He is simply free of it. He has no relationship with language. He has broken the bridge. He lives without language. He lives without thinking. He lives in mochao, in silent, serene reflection. He is a mirror. Because, replied the master flatly, it turns my stomach. Now this will have to be understood. It is a Zen metaphor. Zen people say, there is a constant struggle between the head and the stomach. And the head turns the stomach. The head is very destructive to the stomach. And the stomach is the real seat of your being. The head has become the dictator. Because of language and words and theories and education and learning and knowledge, the head has become almost your seat. It is not. The head can be dropped. And by dropping it, you lose nothing. You gain much. By dropping it, you gain all. Living with the head, you live only in dead words. They cannot satisfy you. They cannot liberate you. Head versus stomach. Just the other night I was talking about the Zen master who used to keep two dolls around him. Almost alike. But inside there was a difference. One doll was too heavy in the head. Must be some heavy metal was put inside the head. Another doll was too heavy at the bottom. In the stomach, heavy metal was put. And they looked alike and they dressed alike. They were always sitting by his sides. And whenever somebody will come and ask what is Zen or what is meditation, and how to attain it, first he will push one doll, the head, heavy doll. It will fall flat and will not be able to get up back. How can it get up? The head is too heavy. And then he will push the other. The bottom is too heavy. You can go on pushing. It pops back and sits again in the Buddha posture. And he says, this is Zen. The stomach. This is East, the stomach. In all old Eastern countries, particularly in the Far East, they have always thought that man lives in the belly. In the old days, just 100 years before, if you had gone to Japan, you would have found people, if you ask them, where do you think? And they will show their belly that we think here. Now they are disappearing, particularly after the Second World War. Japan itself has become like the first doll. The American impact is too much. No, they will laugh. And nobody will tell you that they think from the belly. It looks so foolish to think from the belly. Now they have started thinking from the head. But the emphasis is important. The belly is your source of life. You were joined with your mother from the navel. It is from there that life is started pulsating. The head is the farthest corner of your existence. The center is the navel. Your existence, your being resides there. Your thinking may be in the head, but thinking is a specialization. Just as you use hands for certain purposes, you use legs for certain other purposes, you use eyes for certain other purposes, and ears and nose, so you use your head, your brain mechanism for thinking. But who is using all this? Who uses the legs to walk? And who uses the hands? And who uses the eyes? And who uses the brain? Now, even in Western psychology, they are becoming suspicious about their old idea that brain is the mind. Now, great suspicion has arisen. It is not. Now, few people have started thinking that brain is not the mind. Brain is different from the mind. And you also have sometimes glimpses that the brain is not the mind. For example, you see a man passing on the road. You remember the face. You remember that you had known this man. You remember that you must be knowing his name, and suddenly the name is there on your tongue. And you say, it is on my tongue, I know it is there, but it is not coming up. Now, there are two things. The brain is supplying the name, but it's taking time. The brain says, wait, it is there in the files. Wait. But the one who is waiting is not the brain. Because you know, yes, it must be there. Brain is the mechanism the mind is using. Then you try hard and it doesn't come up. And then, frustrated, you drop the whole idea. And you go into the garden and you start smoking a cigarette and suddenly it is there. You and your brain are two things. The brain is your machinery. Just like everything else is your machinery. This hand is my mechanism. I use it. My brain is my mechanism. I use it. Where is the seat of the mind? Zen says it is in the stomach. It is in the belly. It is in the navel. There exactly from where the first pulsation came, and then it is spread all over. Go back to it. When the master says, because it turns my stomach, he is saying too much brainy people hit hard into my mind. They are a disturbance, they are a nuisance. It turns my stomach. This head versus stomach can be given many formulations. Intellect versus intuition. Logic versus love. Consciousness versus unconsciousness. Part versus whole. Doing versus happening. Death versus life. Having versus being. These seven formulations are possible. And all these seven formulations are significant. Intellect is very, very limited. intuition is infinite. Intuition always comes from the belly. Exactly, whenever you feel something intuitive coming to you, a hunch, it always comes from the belly. Your belly will be affected immediately. When you fall in love, you don't fall from the head. That's why head people call love blind. It is, because it has nothing to do with the brain. When you fall in love, you fall in love from some other source. If you ask great scientists, great poets, great creative people, they will also say that whenever something new happens, it never happens from the head. It never comes out of the brain. It comes from somewhere beyond. Madame Curie was working hard on a mathematical problem for 3 years. And she has done all that can be done. And she was a mathematical genius. And she had failed, utterly failed. Then one night she dropped the whole idea. It seems that she is getting nowhere and she will get nowhere. 3 years is quite long a time for one problem. That night she dropped the idea. Next morning she was going to start something new, to work on some new project. And that night it was solved. In the middle of the night, she woke up, went to the table, and did the whole mathematical problem, solved it, went back and fell asleep. In the morning, when she came back to her table, she could not believe her eyes, because nobody has entered the room except the servant had come in the night to prepare her bed. But the servant cannot do this. Madame Curie has not been able to do. And then she looked more into the handwriting. It was her handwriting. Not exactly, but it was her. She could see it. As if she was drunk. It was a little hazy, shaky. But it was her. From where it has come. Then she remembered a dream in the last night that she had dreamt that she was going to solve the problem and she was writing, and then she remembered the whole dream. She has solved it in the dream. The brain has failed. From the brain there was no answer coming. Now it has come from the belly, from the mind. Exactly the same happened to Buddha. He worked for 6 years, tried every possible way to attain to enlightenment and could not. The same space came as it came to Madame Curie. And one night he dropped the whole project. He said, there is nowhere to go and nothing is going to happen and I forget about it. That night he slept relaxed. And that night he became enlightened. In the morning when he opened his eyes, he was a totally different man. Something has happened in the night. From where? But remember why it happens when you have done everything that you can do. Yes, it happens only then. When your brain capacity is finished to the optimum, only then intuition starts working. It is a higher energy. By using your brain totally, you become capable of using it. From there, you can step towards intuition. Intuition will not work. You can go to Bodh Gaya, and the tree is still alive, under which Buddha became enlightened. And you can sit there, relax, and you can say, I drop all. Nothing will happen. Because you don't have to drop anything. Those 6 years is a must. Great effort is needed to attain to effortlessness. Intellect versus intuition, logic versus love. These are two different styles of being, logic and love. Logic is linear. Love is total. Logic moves in a line, just like language moves in a line. Have you watched this? Language moves in a line, just like logic moves in a line. But existence is not linear. Existence is simultaneous. It is not that I am existing, then you exist, then somebody else exists, then the tree, and then the mountain. We exist all together. Language is a falsification because it puts things into a line. You make a sentence, first one word exists, then another, then another. The grammar makes it certain what words should exist first, then what, how things should follow. That's why Chinese language is one of the most beautiful language, because it is the least of a language. There is no alphabet in Chinese. Because there is no alphabet, Chinese exists totally, simultaneously. It is truer to existence than any other language. It is more fluid. It is not very fixed. It is more like love than like logic. It is more intuitive. It comes more from the belly. It can mean thousand and one things. Because of that, people think it is very unscientific. It is unscientific. Love is unscientific. Existence is unscientific. It can mean different things. It is more poetic. But that's how it is. The tree can mean thousand and one things. The tree has no one meaning. To the painter, it has one meaning. To the woodcutter, it has another. To the poet, it's still another. And to somebody who is not concerned at all, it has no meaning. To the child playing around it, it has another meaning. To the worshipper of a tree, it is a god. It has thousand and one meanings. A tree is not confined in a single meaning. The Chinese language is such that each symbol can mean many things simultaneously. You can come upon it from many directions. But the language is linear. A line moves. One by one, things start happening. In logic also, one by one, things start happening. And if one thing happens, then another cannot happen. Just see to it. If you say one thing, then you cannot say the opposite. You have prohibited it. In existence, the opposite exists together. Life exists with death. Love exists with hate. There is no denying. It is not that love exists, so hate cannot exist. They exist together. Light exists with darkness. But if you make it a sentence, you say, in the room there was light, then you cannot say immediately, in the room there was darkness. Now it has become impossible. You have confined. You have dropped the paradoxical. Existence is paradoxical. And I call Zen the path of paradox. It is paradoxical. Intuition is paradoxical. It is not linear. It is multidimensional. Consciousness versus unconsciousness. But remember, when I say unconsciousness, I don't mean the Freudian unconscious. It is a very poor unconscious. A very small unconscious. It is just the repressed conscious. It is not much. To Zen, unconscious is God. To Zen, the conscious is poor. A small part. Just the tip of the iceberg. And the unconscious is the vast, the enormous, the huge, the unlimited. The conscious has to dissolve into the unconscious. Not otherwise. Not that the unconscious has to become conscious, and that unconscious lives in the belly. But remember, the word unconscious has not good connotations. It seems as if there is no consciousness. No, there is a different kind of consciousness. Not this kind of consciousness that you know. A different kind of consciousness. A separate kind of consciousness. A totally different kind. Intuitive. Not intellectual. Not analytical synthetic. Not divisive. Indivisible. Part versus total. The head is part only. The belly is your totality. The head is just on the circumference. The belly is your center. Doing versus happening. For the head, things are to be done. It is a great doer. For the belly, things only happen. There is no doing. And death versus life. In the head, there accumulates death, because all thoughts are dead. In the belly, life pulsates. And finally, having versus being. Head is a hoarder. It is a miser. It goes on accumulating. Its whole effort is to how to have more and more. Whether it is money or knowledge does not matter. Whatsoever it is, have more of it. Have more women, have more men, have more houses, have more money, have more power, have more knowledge. But have more. And the head goes on trying to have more, because it thinks by having more, it will become more. It never becomes. Because having can never be transformed into being. The belly is the center of being. It does not think in terms of having. It thinks in terms of being. One is. One enjoys this moment of isness. In that moment of isness, all is available. All benediction. All blessing. The Master says, because it turns my stomach, he means all these things. The head is destructive. Drop the head. But by dropping, I don't mean that you are not to use it. You have to use it, but you are not to be used by it. Enough for today. Thank you.